From 90.9 WBUR, this is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up, BU historian and retired Army Colonel Andrew Basevich on what he calls America's long, hopeless war for the Middle East.
If we take on board the entire panoply of military activities that we've undertaken, we sure haven't fixed it. And I think, arguably, we actually have made matters that much worse.
Also today, the Massachusetts House gets set to debate a transgender rights bill that Governor Baker says he'll sign.
It's much more than a bathroom bill. I'm not protected in grocery stores, on highways. Anything that's a public space, I don't have any legal recourse if something were to happen in those spaces.
And Massachusetts' liberalism of the rich, a booming economy and a growing divide between rich and poor.
By the way, this is not unique to Massachusetts. This is happening everywhere that you have these sort of boomtown economies.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to begin this Tuesday after Memorial Day with a look at America's long war in the Middle East. Some would say America's permanent war. Andrew Basevich, a retired Boston University professor, calls it a hopeless war that has stretched on for close to 40 years, from Beirut to Bosnia, from Iraq to Afghanistan, from Libya to Pakistan, from President Jimmy Carter to President Barack Obama. It's a war that America is still fighting, and Basevich says it's not working, and it's time to stop it and rethink our approach to this part of the world. Andrew Basevich is a retired Army colonel. He lost his son fighting in Iraq in 2007. He taught history and international relations at BU, and his new book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, a Military History, and he's with us now. And Professor Basevich, always great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you.
So you date the start of this long war back to 1980 when President Jimmy Carter used his State of the Union address and declared the Persian Gulf was part of the U.S. vital interest. What led Carter to make this commitment, and what has the effect been?
Well, the effect, and it's an effect that Carter himself did not anticipate, my judgment. The effect was to inaugurate the militarization of U.S. policy in the Islamic world. I think it's important to remember that prior to that time, prior to 1980, there were really two parts of the world that the United States considered worth fighting for, both in the context of the Cold War. We were willing to fight for Western Europe, and we are willing to fight for East Asia, indeed had done so, both in Vietnam and Korea. But prior to 1980, there was no significant U.S. military presence or commitment, not even any serious contingency plans that would see the U.S. sending troops into the Islamic world. So that changes beginning in 1980, again with consequences that I think Carter didn't foresee. Why did he act? I think there were domestic political reasons and there were foreign policy issues. You know, domestically, you'll recall, 1980 was an election year. Carter was viewed as a very vulnerable incumbent, and I think he calculated that as he approached the election in November, anticipating that Ronald Reagan was going to be his opponent, he needed to look tough. And why did he need to look tough? He needed to look tough because recent developments had exposed him to the criticism of being weak, two in particular. One was the Iranian Revolution, the overthrow of the Shah, with Iran going from being an ally into an adversary. And equally important, the December 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which gave the impression, falsely, but gave the impression that the Soviet Union was on the march, and from Afghanistan they were going to take Iran and they were going to take Saudi Arabia. So the president declared the Persian Gulf a vital U.S. national security interest, and that set in motion a military misadventure that, in my judgment, continues down to the present day.
And so this is what's so interesting about the history that you've written, because it's almost as if, you know, the United States has been engaged in, I'm sure some people would argue this. I mean, there was Beirut, there's Kuwait, there's Afghanistan, Iraq, on and on it goes. But Why do you view this as one long war as opposed to a series of conflicts? In other words, what ties them all together?
Sure. And first of all, I think that most Americans, to the extent that they attend at all to these varied interventions going back to 1980, do tend to see them as disparate events, right, unrelated. And you can do that. But I think if you do that, then you miss the larger significance of our failure, to use a term I think is appropriate. But what connects them, I think, ultimately what connects them is that beginning in 1980, policymakers, and to some degree Americans in general, fell for the notion that the adroit use of American military power was somehow or other going to fix the place. And so we have been experimenting with ways of employing U.S. military power ever since. We've tried, you mentioned Beirut, you know, we've tried peacekeeping, we've tried regime change, we've tried invade, occupy, and nation building, we've tried counterinsurgency, we've tried counterterrorism, we've tried a wide variety of methods. And when you look at the narrative of 40 years, and they ask what I think is the fundamental question, how are we doing? Mm. Is it getting better? Can we see some ultimate success out there on horizon? The answer is we're not doing well. We're not succeeding. And some people could say, well, we just need to try harder and there'll be some light at the end of the tunnel. My judgment it would be that we've been trying now for going on 36 years and there is no success in the offing. So perhaps it's time to engage in a fundamental reevaluation of our approach to the region.
And I want to talk to you about exactly what you mean by that. But I want to stick to this idea of we've been trying this for 36 plus years and it hasn't worked. What about if I were to say to you, so Saddam Hussein at one point invades Kuwait. The first President Bush initiates Operation Desert Storm, goes in. It's quick. It's decisive. Massive force. He liberates Kuwait, comes back home. Was that a success? Along the way, have there been successful military interventions?
Along the way, there have been successes in an operational sense.
Yeah.
If we evaluate Operation Desert Storm as a distinct entity, in many respects, it was a brilliantly executed campaign, one in which President George Herbert Walker Bush orchestrated an equally impressive diplomatic context. We didn't fight alone in that one.
Mm-hmm.
We got other people to foot the bill so that fiscally we probably came out ahead. However, put it in a somewhat larger context, that really wasn't the first Gulf War. There was a Gulf War between 1980 and 1988. We remember it as the Iran-Iraq War. What we don't remember is that the United States was involved in that war on behalf of Saddam Hussein, that we were engaged in a fight against Iran. And indeed, the outcome of that war in which we were participants really set the stage then for Saddam's actions in August of 1990 when he invaded and annexed Kuwait. Furthermore, if you look just a little bit beyond the operational success of Desert Storm and ask the question, well, what came next? The notion of a clean outcome is, it ain't there. Because what comes next is a U.S. intervention on behalf of the Kurds, who are being beat up by Saddam. Why is he beating up on them? Because Saddam has been able to retain his place in power, leading to a sustained U.S. military commitment justified by the need now to contain Saddam Hussein. So it's not as if we won a great victory and then we were able to come home. I mean, we didn't. The troops did come home and they had their parades, but there was a residual presence that then led to other further unintended, unanticipated consequences, not least among them this guy named Osama bin Laden, who takes offense at the fact that U.S. forces are now permanently stationed in Saudi Arabia.
Hmm. It's interesting. I mean, I'm so interested to ask one more question about Operation Desert Storm, because it and disagree with me, but it seemed to me, sort of observing that point in history, that in a way it was a pivotal war, because in a way it's when we were able to vanquish the ghosts of Vietnam, in a way. I mean, it was a military operation that, as you just suggested, was very successful on an operational level. And it sort of proved the idea that we could use overwhelming force and win. And it seemed to almost set the table for the interventions that followed.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And in that sense, that there's an ironic result of the victory. Yes, we vanquished the ghosts of Vietnam. George Herbert Walker Bush famously says we kicked the Vietnam syndrome, meaning we'll no longer feel restrained with regard to the use of force.
Yeah.
But what comes out of that period of time is an exaggerated confidence in the ability of the United States to use force. That, and I think, really comes to fruition in the wake of 9/11, when George Herbert Walker Bush's son is president, George Herbert Walker Bush's defense secretary is vice president. When they decide that a preventive war targeting Saddam Hussein is going to set the stage for a broader transformation of the greater Middle East. They expected in 2003 a decisive, cheaply won victory because of their reading of the outcome of the war back in 91.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they didn't get that cheap victory. What they got was a quagmire. So things connect in ways that are more often than not are really ironic.
So looking at 36 years, close to 40 years of this endless war, you conclude, when you look at this history and this history of events, of skirmishes, of interventions, of targeted assassinations, of outright war, that it has failed. So what's the alternative? Just pull out, go home? What are you proposing?
No, not pull out, go home. But to emphasize, I mean, this is not a policy book. This is a military history
right.
book. It's trying to
Got
tell
it.
A story of U.S. military involvement. And I do believe that a prerequisite to devising a different approach is to acknowledge the failure of the approach we've been taking.
Yeah.
So point number one simply is, trying harder is probably not going to result in long-term success. So as a policy analyst, what do I think we ought to do? First of all, we need to evaluate realistically the actual threat. I mean, as you and I are speaking, there's a great hullabaloo about ISIS. And ISIS is a vicious organization that needs to be taken on. But ISIS doesn't represent any serious threat to the United States of America. They got no air force, they got no navy, they got no weapons of mass destruction, they've got no allies. They are probably 25 in round numbers, 1,000 relatively lightly armed, vicious killers, but they're 7,000 miles away. And I think the issue there is, rather than assuming that there's a need to project power to keep America safe, to use that phrase,
mm-hmm.
we're wiser to think about what do we need to do to defend ourselves, to protect ourselves from this limited threat.
But I could imagine someone hearing that argument and saying, what, so just let ISIS sort of, I mean, I take your
no.
point that they're not a threat out there 7,000 miles away now, but just let them continue
no,
to
sort I don't, of... And if I may, I think the problem is that so often
yeah.
the conversation gets posed in sort of this binary format that either we've got to fight on until the end of time, or I guess that means we're withdrawing and we're just going to let things happen. And I think there are other choices. And I think the way to begin identifying an additional choice is to ask the basic question, who is threatened by ISIS? Because ISIS does pose an existential threat to the nations in the region,
mm-hmm.
to Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia, to Turkey. And it seems to me that the diplomatic task, and let me emphasize, I'm not trying to suggest that this is something the State Department could do in the next 48 hours. The diplomatic task is to persuade those nations in the region who are facing an existential threat to make common cause against that threat.
Right.
To set aside their differences, which are serious, in recognition of the fact that there is this transcendent problem where they have a common interest in collaborating.
To what extent, in your view of the history, has President Obama changed the course at all? Or has he changed the course at all? Because I know, as we know, he ran for president with an intent on not being a wartime president. He has ended up being a two-term wartime
right.
president. But still, as he articulated at one point, you know, the policy of, you know, not doing stupid things. He hasn't
right.
committed large numbers of troops. He stayed out of Syria. I mean, to what extent does he represent a sort of shift?
Well, I don't think he has stayed out of Syria. It seems to me that we are tippy-toeing into Syria. But that said, the president learned, and maybe it's an obvious lesson, but it's not a trivial one. President learned that invading and occupying countries with an expectation that we can somehow transform them into liberal democracies is a losing proposition. What he has attempted to do is devise alternatives to invade and occupy, and that's where we get sort of the Obama approach of targeted assassinations, special operations forces, relying on air power, training local forces in hopes of getting them to take up the fight, and the result is, and it's again it's something to be noted and appreciated, is that the cost imposed upon the United States for continuing this war under Obama are less than the costs were back in the George W. Bush days. Less money being spent, less American lives. But frankly, not necessarily better outcomes. And so he has been a two-term war president and hasn't done all that well. I think that where Obama, the determining factor in Obama's legacy in this region is going to be determined by how the Iran nuclear deal plays out. I don't think the Iran nuclear deal is particularly about preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. I think that the real rationale, the underlying unspoken rationale, is to end the isolation of Iran with the hope, and it's a very much a hope that remains to be, we'll see how it plays out over time, with the hope that Iran can become a responsible actor in the region. Should it choose to follow that course, then that notion that I just referred to of local actors restabilizing the region becomes at least somewhat more plausible.
Hmm. This idea, though, that 40 years of various forms of warfare have not worked, I mean, it really, you make a strong and compelling case to, as you have articulated, you know, to think of some other way. But I'm at a loss as to sort of figure out how that would work, because I guess I'm thinking of the argument that we've been involved in a big way. We have created all kinds of sort of upset in the region
right.
with all kinds of effects. So in a sense, you know, it's the Pottery Barn mantra. You know, you break it, you it's yours, and you got to stay there and fix it. So I'm worried. I'm unclear how we extricate ourselves, I guess.
Well, I mean, let me not suggest that somehow it's going to be easy. But let me suggest that both morally
yeah.
And pragmatically, simply to persist in a failed policy because extricating yourself from the mess you've made is difficult strikes me as a pretty suspect proposition. Now, I have to say, because here we are in the middle of a presidential campaign, neither of the two likely candidates, as I listen to them, seems particularly inclined to even consider any form of different approach or different policy. Clinton and Trump differ from one another in a host of ways, but both of them basically ignore this narrative that I describe in my book, mm-hmm. focus on the latest manifestation of violence, ISIS, and basically argue, elect me president, and I'm gonna nail these guys.
Yeah,
there is I mean, in a sense, there's an underlying issue here, I think. And one of the underlying issues is the insistence that's been particularly prominent in the Washington foreign policy establishment since the end of the Cold War, that there is no alternative to American global leadership. That if we're not there, wherever, if right. we're not there, things are going to go to hell in a handbasket. Well, we have been there in the greater Middle East. Things have gone to hell in a handbasket. Not entirely our fault. We didn't create the political dysfunction and the local animosities. But we've made matters worse. Yeah. And it seems to me that it is therefore incumbent upon us to find a different way out. And ultimately, that will require obliging local actors to take take primary responsibility for the security and the stability of the region. Ain't going to happen overnight. Probably would be a project that would extend across at least the first term of the next president. But it needs to be done.
The last issue I want to, and we only have about a minute and a half left, but I want to just ask you about this because I was so struck by something that you wrote. I'm not sure it was in the book. It was it was in a piece you wrote for a newspaper, and you came up with this wonderful line: "Culture shapes the American way of war," and you made the point that unlike, for example, the Civil War or World War II, there was a certain buy-in on the part of Americans that sort of defined the kind of wars we fought. That isn't the case today. And in a way, that allows things to continue to drift, if I'm reading you correctly, in the way that they have for the past 40 years, because so few Americans are really paying attention to what's going on.
No question about it. I mean, this really deserves a far longer conversation.
Yeah.
Because we're touching on the question of who serves and who sacrifices.
Right.
And as many others have noted, the reliance on the so-called all-volunteer force, our professional military, has allowed the American people to detach themselves from these wars with insidious consequences.
Yeah. Well, Andrew Bacevich, it's always a great pleasure to have you. Thank you for coming in and talking about these important issues. Retired professor of history, international relations at Boston University, Andrew Bacevich's most recent book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, a preview of the House debate tomorrow on the Massachusetts transgender bill. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. After months of cautiously declining to take a position on the matter, today Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker said he would sign a transgender public accommodation bill if it makes it to his desk. He says he'll sign the House version, and tomorrow the Massachusetts House will begin debate on the bill that would ban discrimination against transgender people in public places like restaurants and sports arenas. It would also specifically allow people to use the restrooms, locker rooms, and changing rooms that match their gender identity rather than their anatomy at birth. The state Senate has already passed the bill. The House is expected to do the same. And with Baker's signature, Massachusetts would join 17 other states with similar laws already on the books. Earlier this month, we spoke to Andrew Beckwith, president of the Massachusetts Family Institute, who opposes the bill. Today, we're joined by Jennifer Levi. She's director of GLAAD's Transgender Rights Project. And Jennifer Levi, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks. Nice to be on the program.
First, let me start with your reaction to Governor Baker's announcement today that he would sign the bill if it's the House version of the bill.
Look, I think it's great that the governor has now spoken out in support of the transgender community's inclusion in Massachusetts law, and I'm very hopeful about a positive vote tomorrow and this bill eventually becoming law.
Right. Now, in 2011, Governor Patrick signed a law extending anti-discrimination protections to transgender people in housing and employment. So tell us why this bill is needed.
Yeah, in 2011, the legislature considered a bill that would have added protections for transgender people across all of the Commonwealth civil rights laws. And you know, for reasons, I guess, that are still being understood, the legislature did not add protections for transgender people in public accommodations, which means, as you said, that transgender people don't necessarily have statewide protections for accessing restaurants, hotels, malls, theaters, et cetera. And so the legislature is coming back to really finish what was left undone in 2011.
Right. And of course, the thing that, as you mentioned, this talks about transgender rights in all sorts of public spaces. What has created the most controversy is the right of transgender people to go into the bathrooms of their choice. So we spoke, as we mentioned, to Andrew Beckwith, president of the Massachusetts Family Institute. And I want to get you to respond to a couple of things that he said. So let's listen to him right now.
If we normalize the presence of anatomical males in spaces that are typically reserved for women, intimate spaces, that endangers both the safety and the privacy of women.
So respond to that. I mean, is that a valid concern that someone might take advantage of this law?
You know, it already sounds like such antiquated thinking, given both the passage of the law in 2011, which, of course, guaranteed transgender people appropriate access to restrooms in the context of employment, and also for transgender students in schools. So the reality is that what the opponents say really misunderstands transgender people. So a transgender boy is a boy, a transgender man is a man, and what they're seeking is restroom access to the men's room. The same thing for a transgender girl or transgender women seeking access to the restroom consistent with who they are. I think what we're finding is that people understand both who transgender people are and the way in which the law has been working since 2011. We see the opposition really diminish.
Yeah. You know, as you know, earlier this month, the Obama administration sent a letter to public schools across the country to insist that transgender people be given access to bathrooms and other facilities corresponding to their gender identity. And I want to just read you a response to that. It came from Peter Schuck, professor emeritus at Yale Law School. He wrote a fairly thoughtful piece in the New York Times. He expressed, first of all, support for protecting the rights of transgender Americans. But I thought he took a stab at sort of trying to explain why this has created such controversy and misunderstanding in this country. And he suggests that the Obama administration's position could actually impede the rights of transgender people by unleashing a backlash. And he says, by treating transgender people's desire to use the bathroom of their choice for a few minutes as a right runs the risk of trampling on all other concerns about privacy and modesty in a setting that many people, you know, want to feel safe in. Can you respond to that? Because I thought it was an interesting attempt to sort of explain the sort of complicated and perhaps complicated set of misunderstandings around this issue.
Yeah, you know, I think that the U.S. Justice Department and President Obama said it best when they recognized that protecting transgender people's rights is about recognizing the dignity and the humanity of individuals, and that if you carve off any particular area as not ensuring protections for the community and waiting, I guess, for some other day to address those issues, you really ultimately undermine the whole point of having the civil rights laws in the first place, which is, of course, to provide protections when people face discrimination, but also to really shift the public understanding about who people are. And, it's not just about having those protections for the few minutes or the, you know, period of time when somebody has to access those facilities, but it's about recognizing the fundamental dignity of transgender people, and that if you carve off an area of the law and say transgender people aren't protected in those areas, you really undermine the protections of the law in the first place.
I want to come back to the bill that the House is going to be debating tomorrow. Baker, the governor, made a point of saying that he supports the House bill as it is written now. And I guess the key difference is, unlike the Senate bill, it includes a provision directing the state attorney general's office to issue guidance for prosecuting anyone who asserts gender identity for an improper use. You're comfortable with that distinction between the bills?
As a description, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is. I mean, there's some other differences as well that relate to the timing that I think are important as well. But that's one of the most significant differences between the House bill being considered tomorrow and the Senate bill that's passed.
So tell us about a couple of the other differences from the Senate bill that you expect to see debated tomorrow.
Well, I mean, there's a number of representatives who would seek to even change the bill as it came out of the Judiciary Committee. So that's one of the problems. I think that'll be the focus of debate. I think that there are some real problems in the ways in which the language that authorizes the Attorney General to issue guidance has been written. I honestly think much of that's insider baseball, and I think it can be addressed in some minor changes to the bill. But, tomorrow the House is really going to be considering broadly the importance of extending protections for transgender people in all areas of public accommodations. And it's really is important and will be a very significant advance for the transgender community if it moves forward. And I hope it does.
All right. Jennifer Levi, Director of GLAAD's Transgender Rights Project. Jennifer, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you. Okay.
And let's turn now to the Remembrance Project, our series of stories from writer Alyssa Eli about ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives. Today, she remembers a Melrose woman who didn't let other people's opinions of her get in her way.
Friends of Terry Savage, and she had many, didn't know the name of the medical condition she was born with. As a child, she needed cardiac surgeries. As an adult, a brain shunt, and she often fell down. They didn't know the name of her psychiatric condition either. Maybe Asperger's, maybe ADHD. They did know she was delightful and difficult, uncomfortably forthcoming, and always brave-hearted. Terry's friend, Gabriella Stelmach, met her at the Bread of Life food pantry, where Terry volunteered.
If you're a person that goes by outside appearances, you could just dismiss her. And many people did, because when she spoke, sometimes she could act as if she was a 12-year-old.
The oddness was unintentional. It was also unignorable, as Terry's friend Ainsley Donaldson and Gabriella remember.
So Terry had recently had her surgery. In comes this brand new person into the office. Hi, I'm Mike, and I'm here to volunteer. And Terry pipes up and says, oh, hi, I'm Terry. I just got done with brain surgery. I'm like, Terry, I turned around, I looked at her, I'm like, Terry, what a shot across the bow. The guy just came in.
Too much information.
Responses could hurt.
I remember one time a homeless person at the bus stop in Malden had called her a retard.
Mm.
Yeah, Terry was very angry and very devastated.
Yet Terry lived life cheerfully forward. There was her reading group and her singing chorale and the tricycle she rode through the streets of Melrose.
What was so amazing about Terry is that with all of her so-called disabilities, socially and physically, she did more than a lot of people. I mean, every time you turn around, it's like, oh, I'm in a bowling league. Oh, and I'm going to the bowling banquet. And I'm going to be at the senior center because they're having a luncheon. Do you want to meet me there? And the number of...
And I'm going on a cruise.
I'm going
by
on a
myself.
Cruise.
I'm going on a cruise.
By myself, yes.
By myself.
Yeah, that was Terry.
When she was 60, after a decade of dogged study, Terry graduated from Bunker Hill Community College. The Bermuda cruise a year afterwards was a gift to herself. Several days before leaving, she fell on a Melrose street. She fell again on the ship and died 10 days later. Friends took up a collection to bring her body back from Bermuda for the funeral and burial. There might not have been certainty about her diagnoses, but there was never any doubt about what she meant to them.
I realized that I got it backwards, that I thought that I was doing her a favor by being her friend. And in fact, she was doing me a huge favor by being my friend. And that's what I miss.
Alyssa Eli, remembering Terry Savage of Melrose, who died last July at the age of 61. If you'd like to suggest someone for remembrance, you can find out how to do that at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, journalist Tom Frank on Massachusetts liberalism of the rich. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In his new book, the journalist Thomas Frank offers a passionate critique of Massachusetts Democrats and the booming economy that they've helped create. He calls Boston the spiritual home of the professional class and a place where modern liberalism has grown and flourished without restraint. He calls it a liberalism of the rich. Frank says it has helped fuel a booming innovation economy, but also the highest rates of economic disparity in the nation. Thomas Frank came in recently to talk about this and about his new book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. He says the Massachusetts economy and the politics of this very blue state have been shaped in a big way by the high number of private colleges and universities and their close relationship with business.
Well, Route 128 is a sort of classic example, and MIT is the classic example of the university that has launched, you know, so many business enterprises, mainly in high tech and in defense contracting. These are all industries that the Democratic Party loves to celebrate and to talk about how noble they are and how the people who work there are really high quality people. You know, basically this class of people who innovate. And this is, you know, no big surprise here. This is the same group of people that the Democratic Party looks to as constituency number one in their coalition of voters, the white collar professionals. This
right.
is their most favored group of constituents.
You also point out, so here we are with this booming knowledge economy and this booming innovation economy, but we also have the highest rates of income disparity, yawning gap between rich and poor. So how do the policies that encourage the innovation economy and the knowledge economy feed that wealth gap?
Mainly because they don't care about it. You know, this is once you decide that the only people that really matter in your economic worldview are members of the, you know, the white collar professional class, and keeping them happy is very important, and making sure that it's really easy for people to innovate. But at the same time, switching off your concern about working people, well, that's naturally what's going to happen. By the way, this is not unique to Massachusetts. This is happening everywhere that you have these sort of boomtown economies.
You put a pretty fine point on the critique when it comes to Boston. At one point, you say Boston is the headquarters for two industries, higher education and big medicine, that are steadily bankrupting middle-class America. And I wanted to ask you, is it really fair to say that the Democrats that run this very blue state and city are responsible for the runaway costs of healthcare and higher ed? Because I guess one could argue that they spend a lot of time worrying about how to control those costs.
Look, it is Democrats and liberals who have given us this sort of modern idea we have that everybody must go to college, that college is the only way to succeed. It's the only way to raise yourself up in the world, you know, not by hard work or something like that, but by going to college, by studying very specific things. And they have drummed this, I should say drilled this, into a generation of students and also of parents. And everybody in America knows this. They have to send their kid to college. What do the colleges do? What do they do when you say that they basically control the gates to the middle class way of life? Well, of course, they keep jacking up the prices every year, 5% every year. And look, the Democrats have it in their power to do something about this, but they would rather not. They choose not to. These are their friends. These are their classmates. If you look at who donates to Democrats, university systems are always way up there. Right up there with Wall Street, actually. Yeah.
And when you say that the Democrats have the power to do something else, what specifically are you talking about? Because you're really describing a major shift from the kind of Rooseveltian New Deal idea of what the Democrats should be or could be and are not, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they could have a completely – they don't have to have a worldview where the university is the center and focus and the sort of, the hub – if you will, of the universe. You know, that not everybody thinks about the world that way. That's a specifically – it's a way of looking at the world that belongs to a specific class. There's also, in policy terms, things that they could be doing differently. I mean, President Obama has enormous power over the universities of America. And he's talked about, you know, about doing things to rein in the annual tuition increase. But the stuff that he's proposed is very weak indeed. But you look at what the Department of Education gives to these institutions, to these universities, or you look at the tax breaks that these universities get from the cities that host them. There's all sorts of ways that they could be reined in. But nobody has the will. Nobody wants to.
Speaking of tax breaks and the way local policy supports the innovation economy, I want to listen to a couple of cuts of tape. So as you probably know, General Electric is moving its headquarters to Boston. So here's Jeff Immelt. He's the CEO of GE, talking about the company's decision to move its headquarters to Boston. GE is getting $150 million in tax incentives. Now, GE is giving $50 million worth of philanthropy to Boston Public Schools. So here's Immelt, who says this will benefit the city and the state in a big way.
Over time, the returns are going to be vast to the people of Boston, the people of Massachusetts, in terms of job creation, investment in the community, salaries, real estate, things like that. This is an investment that ought to be really great for the people in Boston.
And Tom Frank, one more piece of tape. This is Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, a rock-solid pro-union Democrat, talking about the benefits of giving tax breaks to a company like GE. Here's what he said.
There's an opportunity here, bringing in one of the largest companies in the world to invest in our city. The spinoff of that for taxes, which will be reinvested back in our economy, back into our schools, our police, our fire, you can't put a figure on that.
So there are two sort of arguments for developing and supporting the innovation economy. Is Mayor Walsh wrong to say that, do you think?
Basically, the argument is, you know, Republicans have their sort of version of this where you cut taxes and you lure companies to your city. Either way, you are, as a city, abasing yourself before a certain class of people. Hmm. You know, it's not something that you want to see in a democracy.
Hmm. And as an example of where you observe the wealth gap, you know, really dramatically in this state, you compared what you observed in Boston, like, you know, in the Innovation District, with what you saw in a city like Fall River. Right?
Yeah.
So well, describe that contrast.
It's a manufacturing city, a manufacturing town. Manufacturing has all gone overseas. What's most striking about Fall River is that the factories haven't been torn down. They're all still there. And so as you drive around the city, that kind of puts you in this sort of contemplative mood, thinking about the time when blue-collar people were the ones, the vast majority of Americans were the ones that we made policy for. They were the ones that we tried to benefit. And we did to some degree, by the way. From the Great Depression up until the 1990s, or the 1980s anyway, when the country prospered, working-class people prospered too, and wage growth, economic growth was distributed to the bottom 90% of the population as well. Since the last few years of the Bill Clinton administration, the late 90s, all that economic growth has gone to the top 10% or so. And that's a question of policy. That's not, you know, the invisible hand of God that came down and did that. We did that. And by and large, Democrats did that.
See, it's interesting that you say it's not the invisible hand of God, because I think one of the arguments that you'll hear, I mean, to talk about an example like Fall River, people will say, well, this is the result of deindustrialization, global business trends that have created new winners and new losers, right?
That's like saying a crime wave is caused by more crime. Seriously. So when people talk about globalization, by the way, Democrats in particular love to talk about globalization. They think it's so virtuous. You know, we all know what globalization is. It's when we move blue collar work overseas and get that stuff done much more cheaply. And that's just what globalization is. And, you know, it's as though the sort of, you know, the forces of the globe itself were doing this to us. But no. Trade agreements are written by humans. They're not written by the globe. They're written by humans. They're, in fact, written mainly by lobbyists nowadays. And what those lobbyists do in those trade agreements is they figure out ways to advance their own interests and harm the interests of other groups.
Hmm.
And all of our trade agreements are written this way. Can I tell you something that I learned when I was writing this book?
Yes, please.
You could write a trade agreement to benefit any group and to harm any other group. I can give you an example. We could import high-quality lawyers and doctors into this country in enormous numbers, and it would be gravely harmful to the professional class in this country. And we could ensure quality standards, and we could import generic pharmaceuticals from India, and we could ensure quality standards. It would be the end of Big Pharma. They'd be the ones deindustrialized. But you know who it would be good for? be good for average citizens. It'd be good for blue-collar people who have to pay $1,000 a pill or who have to pay so much to go and see their doctor. It would make legal services very, very cheap. You could do this.
So it's policy, not the invisible hand.
It's not the globe doing this. It's the people in Washington, D.C. who negotiated these treaties, and they chose one group over another group, and that is all there is to it.
But, Tom, I mean, it's practically an article of faith in this part of the world that innovation is a good thing. I mean, is...
Yeah, well, you hear that everywhere you go. I mean, people talk about it as though it was a kind of a form of charity. When you do innovation, you're automatically benefiting mankind. But then you look back over the history of innovation and the kind of things that innovation has given us. I mean, Enron was a very, very innovative company. And lest we forget, you know, the instruments that brought the global economy to its knees in 2008 were financial innovations, right? These were things that Democrats used to celebrate. I mean, innovations are not automatically a force for good. I mean, they have to be judged on the merits the same as everything else. It's like talking about globalization. It's just a way of putting over something that should be scrutinized, something that might even be controversial, like Uber, and just saying, oh, nothing to see here. This is just innovation. It's just, you know, God's in his heaven. All's right with the world.
Right. Now, you mentioned Uber. I just want to get you to explain that. What's wrong with Uber? It makes it easier for me.
It's very convenient,
me.
Right?
Yeah. Convenient for people like me.
Yes, exactly.
It costs less. They come when I call and they take me where I want to go the way I want to go.
Exactly. But what about the people who, you know, who shed their blood building a taxi driver's union over the years and you know, making sure that certain safety rules were in place and making sure that this was a job that you could live on. And now it's basically Uber has opened up what will essentially, I think, become a race to the bottom. And you can extend that logic to so many. And of course, the innovators are extending that logic to so many other different fields of enterprise and of work and of labor. And it's a formula for casualizing any kind of labor.
Yeah. And in the case of Uber, I pay less, but the driver gets less. But then the unionized driver becomes obsolete. And the people
right.
who are making the big money are the innovators.
Right. Back in Silicon Valley. Right.
So what were the forces that caused the sort of powerful Democrats to shift away from the New Deal style of Democratic policies toward this new kind of, third way style of Democratic policies?
Yeah, it has a long history, and it, you know, goes back to the days of the Vietnam War, when organized labor, as you might recall, was you know, by and large supported President Johnson on Vietnam. And things, you know, the country was seemed to be coming apart in those days. And the Democrats basically decided they would remove organized labor from its position of – from a structural position within the Democratic Party. Organized labor looked pretty bad in those days. You know, you can understand them making that decision, but what they didn't get at the time is that when you remove workers' organizations, when you take their voice away, you're also taking away workers' issues. You're taking away, you know, and you're basically setting the table for what has happened ever since, which is towering inequality. And today they think it's working. Today they think they'll be able to win the White House from here to eternity.
What about people like Senator Elizabeth Warren? She's a Democrat who seems to be raising the alarm about oversized rewards of the rich. Is she the exception among Democrats in your view?
I think so, yeah. I think she is an exception. You know, and Bernie Sanders is another one. And it's not a coincidence, by the way, that Bernie Sanders, for all those years, was not a Democrat, didn't identify himself as a Democrat. It's very interesting. And Elizabeth Warren also comes to the Democratic Party from an unusual place, by which I mean Oklahoma, and by which I mean being a Republican, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, are you encouraged at all by the race for the Democratic nomination? You mentioned Bernie Sanders. He talks a lot about income inequality. Whether he wins or not, do you think his message is resonating and perhaps pushing Hillary Clinton in the country?
I'm very excited by what I'm seeing. And now, look, I'm a journalist. I can read newspapers, and I fully expect that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. I mean, the party is united behind her, even if the voters aren't. But I think she'll be the nominee. And if the Republicans choose Donald Trump, I think Hillary Clinton will be the president. But I also think she will be a fairly conservative president, by which I mean nothing will change. You know, the center will hold and inequality will grow worse. All the problems that we're talking about here will get worse. And 4 years from now, you're going to see another Bernie Sanders, but you're also going to see another Donald Trump. You know, this is just going to grow in the next couple of years.
Well, Thomas Frank is a journalist. His new book is called Listen, Liberal. You can find a link to his piece that was adapted from the book about Massachusetts and the blue state model, how the Democrats created a liberalism of the rich, at RadioBoston.org. Thomas Frank, thanks so much. This has been great.
It's my pleasure.
Yep, so that's one point of view. And check out Thomas Frank's piece and let us know what you think. You can leave a comment at RadioBoston.org, or you can tweet us or leave a comment on Facebook at Radio Boston as well. And that's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.